Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It is your tea room, your Chinese tea room of free speech, where you come and they'll pour oolong tea or the black tea or whatever kind of tea you want. Maybe green tea. That Japanese green tea is pretty good. I like that. And we sip it and speak freely. We do. There's a lot to talk about because there's a lot that needs to be said. And we're going to be discussing some interesting articles here. And you do want to make sure that tea is not kosher certified, because there's no reason tea should be kosher certified. I mean, what could be so horrible about tea that it needs to be, that you need to have a bunch of rabbis certifying it as kosher? I don't know. So download the kosher-tified app from nationalbugle.com. Learn about the kosher question. Educate yourself, because an educated consumer is the master of his own destiny. Hey, that's good. All right. Cato, welcome to the show.
Yes, glad to be back, Dr. Slattery. This is white nationalism with Chinese characteristics.
Okay. Hey, I said something about, like, nationalism, what, civic nationalism with white characteristics. Did you hear me say that?
I think so. Yeah, I think.
Okay. I used that phrase within the past week. And that's, I like the white nationalism with Chinese characteristics, too. It is, and of course, this is all based on China's system supposedly being socialism with Chinese characteristics. Whether it's socialism or not, I don't know. I always think of it as pragmatism, but it does have Chinese characteristics, and that is something we'll be looking at, those Chinese characteristics today. But there's a couple of articles that you've had me take a look at, and we're going to discuss them. One comes from UNCE.com. We don't exactly know who the author is. I guess he's an anonymous author. Do you want to introduce that for us?
Yes, yeah, so this is a relatively new author on UNS, on the UNS Review. It looks like he just started writing for the UNS Review last month. He goes by the name of Rashes, which, yeah, it's you know, for obvious reasons, he wants to keep anonymous, just like we are, to a huge degree. And, he basically wrote this article. It's titled, America is a Nation of Hate. Of course, that first sentence, I would disagree right there and say America is not a nation. It's not a nation. It's an empire. So America is an empire of hate. But nonetheless, this is a very good article and basically sums up, the reasons why, as the audience may know, I'm not exactly very fond of the United States of America. And some may conclude, well, it's because you're Chinese, because I'm Chinese, and therefore, I have no heritage, ancestral connections to America, so it's easy for me to say. And yeah, that's true. But this article right here will sums up really good why the United States Empire is to be despised throughout the entire world by all peoples. So I guess, let's see, how do we want to do this? I guess I'll just start reading the article and then
okay,
we'll...
Okay, well, yeah, I'm going to comment just before that. The article is... I guess it starts off talking about the 1940s and World War II. And if you go to the 1940s and you look at America, because you made the comment America's not a nation, it's an empire. And, okay, America, what is America? And then who are the Americans? I think, like, if you're talking about, say, the mid-20th century, in America, you had it was 85% plus white, close to 90%, maybe, you know, it depends. If you're not going to count Jews, and if you're not going to count the Mexicans, who weren't very many, and actually at the time the Mexicans in America might well have considered themselves white, because it was before the whole Hispanic category. But depending on how you count Jews and Mexicans, you're talking about like between maybe 85% and 88% white. And those people, those Europeans, Christians of European descent, I would say they were a nation, whether you want to equate that with America, or say maybe America was a geographic entity that had this recently amalgamated white nation, because, you know, it was a lot of those people were people who were descendants, children of immigrants, grandchildren of Ellis Island's immigrants from various parts of Europe. So if to the extent it was a nation, it was a very new one. And then there's maybe you might even say there was a separate black nation that lived within it. But at any rate, I don't know. But that's kind of a distraction from where we're going with this. So the article, America, a Nation of Hate, or something like that. Okay, so where's the article going?
Okay, well, first it starts out, I don't think I'm going to read all this, because it's the first part, because it's kind of long. Well, the first part basically talks about in World War II, when a lot of American GIs would collect Japanese soldier skulls and send them back to their girlfriend or wives.
They talked about one. Was that something that happened much?
It happened quite a bit. If you read, was it Tom Goodrich's book, Summer, the Harvest, the Hate? Mm-hmm. The second edition to Hellstorm, he talks a lot about just the American atrocities against the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where I'm going to start, is after it talks about this. He first says this quote. He says, "War is peace, freedom is slavery, death is life. By American standards, what should I call a quote-unquote good American?" So that's how he starts. And then this is where he defines America, because we're talking about, first of all, what is the definition of America to be worthy of being hated. So this is what he says about America. He says in this paragraph, quote, "America is an empire of hate. Its culture and genetics are irreparably, incorrigibly suffused with the hatreds and jealousies of degenerate, low-class religious fanatics who fled in patricidal hatred from the order and culture of Europe. Their fratricidal scions then murdered, defiled, and enslaved their better brothers to the south." That's the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression, "primarily Americans who journeyed to the New World for better reasons, the Americans who were essentially European in outlook, the brothers who were growing up to be too much like daddy, like you."
Okay, so I just want to, while we show the connection in people's brains, so when he's, the first people he's talking about who fled, or who left Europe, religious hate, he's not talking about Jews, he's talking about Puritans, right?
Right, about the Puritans, right.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
By that.
Which, you know, the Puritans is a whole other story. They're a broad group of people, and this is... Yeah, but that's another story. But here's what he continues, and he says, "With hate, thus a hegemony in America, the Americans then invaded Europe twice, destroyed the European fatherland, and commenced the long-term mass homicidal spree, which has made America the most despised place on Earth." And then he contrasts that, and he says, "Now, let us see the images of a nation of peace, love, and friendship between nations and races." And he's talking about National Socialist Germany being this nation of peace, love, and friendship. And then he has an example of there's a picture of a Japanese girl teaching a German girl how to use chopsticks, and talking about basically, "Oh yeah, this is these people are so evil, whereas America's, you know, all about good, and these innocent, you know, beautiful girls, the Japanese and German girls, are supposed to be evil according to the eyes of Americans." And they go into detail about that. But then we jump down here, and the guy says, he says, quote, "As I have said before, Adolf Hitler was the leader of the free world. In National Socialist Germany, the free and independent Germany was also the great builder of a non-destructive harmony amongst races and nations. Interracial friendship without deracination international peace without international Bolshevism, the respectful building of cross-cultural bridges without the countercultural mass destruction of so-called multiculturalism. So this is him talking about Germany, basically saying, essentially promoting harmony among the races and against Bolshevism. And then he says, quote, "Of course, the Americans, those great masters of the big lie, that's the Holocaust, will accuse the Germans of having done what the Americans actually did, preach peace as a falsehood while rampaging through the world with murderous bloodlust and grand-scale massacres. America, the empire of hate, is also the empire of hypocrisy, chutzpah, and the trick of accusing one's own victims of the crimes that one commits against them." And then he says, "Thus the Germans, who foremost dared to love themselves, love their race, and love their traditions, are accused of hate by those who preach love while practicing hatred. Americans, for whom hate is practically a national religion, an empire religion. And the Germans are frequently accused of having contracted a military alliance of mere convenience by those who cannot imagine taking an interest in other people's cultures without a two-faced, underhanded, do-gooding meddler's cultural imperialism. The Germans' sincere overtures of friendship and to other civilized peoples were reciprocated. East and West joined in cultural harmony, and they joined politically and military in an anti-Comintern pact. Comintern was the Bolsheviks' own abbreviation for Communist International. And what then, and as what were then the most powerful of the free nations, Germany and Japan, united militarily in common defense of their own freedoms." And the Axis of Freedom went much further than that. And then he actually talks about China during this time. And he says, quote, "Amidst China's multi-way civil war, both Germany and Japan reached out in friendship to the Chinese leader who had been the most successful in fighting off British influence, a free and independent Chinese leader whom the Maoist and American history books describe as a puppet, or in Chinese we call Han Jian, you know, Han traitor. But this guy was far from a Han Jian. He was actually the most nationalist, most legitimate Chinese leader at the time."
You know, so his name, Wang Jingwei?
Yes, Wang Jingwei.
And, you know, they're also going to be talking about an Indian leader who I am familiar with, but we can talk about him later. But Wang Jingwei, I'm sure I've heard of him, but no, I wasn't really familiar with him. But I'm looking here at the caption, and it shows his name in Chinese. And Wang, I mean, most Wangs are written with the name of the king. This actually is slightly a little bit different. But the Jingwei is written with the characters for pure defense.
What? Yeah.
Pure defense. So it was just defensive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I that kind of strikes me.
Well, he was definitely a noble Chinese man for sure. He's basically the you could say the Viking Quisling. What Viking Quisling was to Norway, what Henri Philippe Pétain was to France, and what Oswald Mosley and John Amory were to Great Britain, the United Kingdom, Wang Jingwei was to China.
There was. I'm trying to remember when Ferdinand Marcos was overthrown in the Philippines, and this is not around 1986 or 88, maybe 86. Aquino, Corazon Aquino, this lady became president, and then she had a vice president whose name I can't remember the first name, but his last name I think was Laurel, Salvador Laurel. And his father had been the president of the Philippines during World War II under Japanese occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was supposedly a Japanese collaborationist, whereas Marcos had fought and bled alongside Americans. And I don't know a whole lot about the Philippines, but the fact of the matter is that all over Asia, there were important nationalists who were cooperating with the Japanese against the Americans and the British.
And the Soviets.
And the Dutch. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the article continues. It talks about Wang Jingwei, and this is what he says. He says, quote, "Far from being a puppet, Wang Jingwei was, at the time, the only credible Chinese leader who both, number one, was neither Soviet nor American influenced, and number two, governed any significant amount of Chinese territory. He was of the governor of Nanjing. The reorganized nationalist government of Nanjing was Wang Jingwei. And then the article continues and talks about, the Indian nationalist leader, Subhash Chandra Bose, and talking about the alliance between Japan, China under Wang Jingwei, and then India under Subhash Bose. And talking about, and this, I'll just read this sentence. He says, join free India with free China and free Japan. It was to overthrow British rule. Join free India and free China and free Japan in a pan-Asian power bloc. With this eastern bulwark aligned with Aryan Europe under German leadership, the free world would have been saved from the tyranny of Soviet-American globalist internationalist conquest. And then he says, it was a beautiful world that could and should have been. The world was destroyed by the Jews' janissaries. The Americans, who could no more pass off the guilt of their own crimes on the Jews they made their masters, then a goy hitman can pass off all blame to his Jewish boss who ordered a murder. So this right here is a very important point, where he says that the American Empire, is just as responsible for all the destruction of, you could say, Aryan Europe and East Asia, just as much as the Jews are, because it's the Americans that did it by the way of the Jews, or the Jews that used the Americans to do it. So the Americans are just as guilty, just like a hitman is just as guilty as the boss. The Jewish mob boss. And by the way, there's a picture here too with General Tojo and Wang Jingwei and Subhash Chandra Bose, the Indian leader, all together.
Yeah, Chandra Bose, by the way, I've never been there, but he was buried in a cemetery in Tokyo. That much I know. But this is a really interesting and point or assertion that's being made, that the Americans are just as guilty as the Jewish bosses who actually. Okay, so there's an acknowledgement that the United States is under de facto Jewish control or domination, but that the Americans are guilty for being dominated. And this is like an important philosophical and political question. I talk about Jewish power riding the zombie corpse of America and other Western countries to global domination. Zombie corpse. Is it really a zombie corpse? Because zombies don't have free will. Is it really a zombie corpse? To what extent should the United States, the people of the United States, know better? If the people of the United States are being fooled by this Jewish ruling class, if they're being tricked, what is the level of guilt? And this goes back to, if you go to the Yasukuni Shrine Museum in Tokyo, which is very, very controversial, because the Yasukuni Shrine was built sometime, I guess, around, I don't know, it was before or after World War I, but it's been around for a long time, and it enshrines Japan's war dead, right? It was already established before World War II, and of course there was an awful lot of Japanese war dead in World War II, including the leaders of the Japanese military, who, because of victor's justice, have been branded as Class A war criminals. And when Japanese politicians visited officially in Prague, and this is still a big issue, we were talking about the prime minister or the presidential race for the leading party a week or two ago, and that's been settled, but it was an issue there. Will you go and visit the Yasukuni Shrine? But at any rate, I guess probably a week from now we can talk about the new Japanese prime minister, who is Kishida. But we'll talk about that next week after he's put together a cabinet and we have an idea of what direction he's going in. But there's a museum there at the shrine, and the museum has its own particular take and interpretation of history, and that's also what makes this so controversial. But we're at the break. We're going to take the break, and we'll be right back. Oh, no, Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Extendivite 7-herb formulation is approved to help maintain cardiovascular health and help lower blood lipid levels in adults. Extendivite is made from hawthorn, garlic, valerian, cayenne, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, and milk thistle. The herbs in Extendivite have been chosen for their ability to help with overall health. Many people have reported improved energy and stamina in just a few months. If you think you could feel just a little bit better, then Extendivite may just be for you. Extendivite is an all-natural supplement. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org. And click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
So we're back, and we're finishing up about the Yasukuni Shrine's version of history. The Yasukuni Shrine, the version of history that's presented in that museum, it's not the same as the history in the Japanese textbooks, which are, you know, government-sanctioned, which are the textbooks themselves, the official government position. There's basically three interpretations of Japanese history. There's the one, the victor's justice, that the Japanese were completely wrong, and this was the Tokyo Tribunal, and then of course it's been adopted by the Chinese government, and maybe even in a harsher way. The Japanese version accepts the basics that Japan was wrong and this and that, but it kind of just waters it down. It just waters it down. Instead of saying Japan invaded China, it'll use terms like Japan proceeded into China, that type of thing. And then, but the Yasukuni version is, you know, Japan was right to do these things. And regarding China in particular, that China allowed itself to become weak and infected with these Western empires. Right, these Western colonial empires. So China bears a responsibility for allowing itself to be so weak and bringing this like Western imperialism, to East Asia. And yep. China needed to be invaded for that reason. And this is the same logic now that he is applying to the United States and other Western countries, that the United States and other Western countries, the non-Jews, bear a responsibility for allowing themselves to be the basis of Jewish power. And that's interesting. That's something that, you know, we should ponder.
Yeah, and even more so because in China, they basically were just so weak, they allowed themselves to be humiliated and walked over by all these Judeo-Western imperialist powers. But they didn't go along with, well, they couldn't have because at the time they were very weak. But the American Empire is even more guilty because they actually carry out the Jewish hegemony, the Jewish domination of the world.
And you could also say that at the time that the United States succumbed to Jewish domination, it was the strongest nation in the world, or the strongest country in the world, strongest state. Mm-hmm. So it came under domination at a time when it was at peak strength, whereas China, and maybe one of these days we'll look into why, it had a few bad centuries. And so, in the 1800s, even though China had been, in the past, it had been very advanced civilization, it was so weak and just ripe for the picking in the 1800s.
Right. Exactly. I'm going to finish this article. I'll try to finish it before the break. But this last part of this article is very important. So basically, the second part, he titles it The Future of the Free World. And here's what he says. He says, quote, "The free world led by Germany is lost. Corruption and tyranny now rule the world. We are in a new dark age. For my part, I do not hate any race, except for Jews, Americans, and rhymes with triggers." I wonder who he's talking about. Rhymes with triggers.
So we don't even know who wrote it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. We don't. But he says here, "I wish to extend my hand in peace and friendship to the decent peoples of this world, in the hope that a new free world may be built in the future." And then he continues and he says, "In no particular order of precedence, and without hereby opinioning the tragic tensions between some of these peoples, I respectfully invite to proms Japanese, Chinese, Hindu traditionalists who have watched their culture destroyed by American-led Western liberal influence even after independence, so-called, Arabs who respect Europeans' rights to their homelands as much as I respect Iraq and Palestine, Iranians, Afghans, and, of course, Europeans who wish to restore European blood, honor, and territorial sovereignty. Russians who will understand that my war-born wrath is primarily directed at the Soviet government, which was imposed on Russia by Americans and dominated by Jews." Yes, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. It's absolutely true. And this last part is very important, too, because this will differentiate between true patriotic Americans and the American Empire, the evil American Empire. And here's what he says, the last part he says, "Dissident individual Americans who agree with that of the greatest of American patriots, like Professor Revelo P. Oliver," who I'm vaguely familiar with. I know Revelo P. Oliver. I know Dr. David Duke has mentioned him a few times.
I don't know who he is.
Yeah, he was a white nationalist figure in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
But then he says, "In this article, I have shamelessly copied Chinese and Japanese names I cannot read." Okay, well, that's just him kind of. Let me read down to the.
You know, we can probably assume he's not an Orient or not an Oriental himself, because he can't.
No, that's one thing we know, that he's not an Oriental himself, because he could just be an American-born Chinese, although I doubt it.
Could be.
Can't read, but it's. That's definitely.
He should be able to pronounce if he was brought up in even like a fourth or fifth generation Chinatown place. But we're at the break. Let's finish this on the other side.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the Republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the Republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. Fuck you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
Okay, so we're back. Let's finish up this first article.
All right, so the one last sentence he says that sums it all up, he says, quote, "And culturally and politically, I seek to bring together the good and aristocratic people and urge unity against the American monstrosity of hate, greed, and megalomania that has all but destroyed the whole world." That was his final sentence.
Hmm. Yeah, and so he's got some novel ideas that some of which are new to me, and I want to like think about them. Some interesting points there. So I'll just say thank you for introducing us to this. I don't have a final conclusion to make on it, but those are some interesting ideas.
Yes, absolutely. Other than whoever this author is, he did a pretty good job, a very good job, I would say, and really summed it up. So I shout out to this author and give credit to him for coming up with this article.
Okay, so what's next?
Okay, so the next article I found, or rather, it's actually a video, but this was also on uns.com. This is Michael Hudson.
And the transcript of the video.
Right, a transcript of the video, but I'm gonna play the video.
Okay.
Where basically this is on RT's show called Renegade Inc., and basically it's there's the British host interviewing Michael Hudson, who is a economist. He lives in the U.S., but he's an expert on China's economy, and he talks about essentially how China's model is superior to America's model. And I guess we can get started on the video here. So here we go.
Welcome to Renegade Inc. With China's increasing wealth, Western investors want some of the action. One of those investors is a bullish gentleman called George Soros. However, the Chinese are acutely aware that with Western investment comes inequality. So, as Beijing begins to rethink how to do proper economic growth, we ask, will China learn from Western mistakes? Michael Hudson, always great to have you back on Renegade Inc.
It's good to be back here. Thanks for having me.
Michael, we join you at a time where the world, a lot of people think that the unipolar world could have maintained its supremacy. Turns out it hasn't. Multipolar world is here to stay. You, of late, have been quite vocal about George Soros, no less. Mr. Soros has been casting aspersions about various things, but one of them is talking about the Chinese economy. And why BlackRock, amongst others, should be allowed to invest there, because ultimately it's going to undo American interests. Can you unpick that for us? Because it seems very complicated.
Well, George Soros' dream is that China would do what Yeltsin did to Russia, that it would privatize the economy, that it would basically carve it up and let U.S. investors buy control of the most profitable heights. And in that way, the foreign investors would be able to sort of get all of the profits of Chinese industry, Chinese labor, and it would become the darling stock market of the world, just like Russia's stock market was the leading booming stock market of 1994 to 96, and that China essentially would be run to benefit U.S. investment bankers. And Soros is furious that China is not following the neoliberal policy that the United States is following. It's following a socialist policy, wanting to keep its economic surplus at home to benefit its own citizens, not American financial investors. And so this is a real clash. For Soros, this is a clash of civilization. And he said, somehow we've got to stifle the Chinese economy. We've got to put sanctions against it. We've got to stop investing in it, to force it to do to its country what Yeltsin did to Russia.
Let's hear it in his words. He says the BlackRock initiative imperils the national security interests of the U.S. and other democracies because the money invested in China will help prop up President Xi's regime, which is repressive at home and aggressive abroad. Congress should pass legislation empowering the Securities and Exchange Commission to limit the flow of funds to China. The effort ought to enjoy bipartisan support. He's not mincing his words, is he?
Well, he's a real comedian. What's wrong with that statement? He thinks that China actually needs American dollars in order to build its factories and invest. He thinks that somehow China's balance of payments is going to fall apart without the U.S. market, and without U.S. investors telling President Xi what to do. The Chinese government won't have a clue as to what to invest in and how to let the free market, meaning George Soros and BlackRock and other companies, operate. So he's living in a dream world where other people need us. It's like a guy who doesn't realize that the girlfriend doesn't need him anymore.
There seems to me to be a distinction here that the Chinese are acutely aware of, and it's between the classical economists and the neoclassical economists. The classical economists have understood the idea of unearned wealth, unearned income. The neoclassical economists actively chase unearned wealth, unearned income, because that is central to their playbook. Can you just expand on those two ideas? And is it the case that that's why you talk about a clash of civilizations?
Well, you've put your finger on it, Ross. People think that China's advantage is its abundant low-priced labor force or the government-building infrastructure. But what's guiding this all is an understanding of the kind of economics that actually goes back even beyond Marx to Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and the other economists. They realize there's a difference between earning and creating wealth by employing labor to produce goods to sell at a profit and then reinvesting the profits in more capital formation, or simply buying a rent-yielding property, buy land and letting it rise in price without the landlord doing anything, buying a monopoly and just raising the price and charging monopoly prices like the U.S. pharmaceutical companies are doing. China understands the difference between earned income and unearned income, between productive investment and unproductive investment. And in the United States, if they do recognize this difference, they realize that unearned income, you can make wealth by parasitically much quicker than you can actually create wealth. It's cheaper to be a parasite than a host.
It's cheaper to be a parasite than a host. So he just called out the U.S. economic system as parasitic. I wonder where he gets that from. Or wow. I wonder what he's talking about without actually mentioning who.
It's, yeah. And so Michael Hudson, I'm not familiar with him. And that doesn't mean he's not a big deal. It just means I've been out of academia for so long. Do you know what university he's affiliated with?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I can look it up.
It's not that important.
Mm-hmm.
But these are interesting ideas. So the difference between, he said classical and neoclassical. The difference between productive investment and what was the other type?
Versus unproductive investment.
Productive is where you're going to be manufacturing or actually producing things. The unproductive, where you're simply acquiring an asset that you get rents off of. Rents, like whether it's real estate rents, whether it's monopolistic rents. You acquire a drug that's got a patent on it, and so you're not doing anything new. You just raise the price on it, and parasitic. But before, so we don't miss it. At the beginning, there was this discussion that. So a lot of people know that BlackRock, because Fast the Nation was talking about it earlier this year. BlackRock has received permission from the Chinese authorities to open a investment fund that is not majority Chinese owned, right? So it'll be a majority BlackRock owned, and they're the first one. Now China has a extremely large financial market, stock market, and so you've got investment funds in there, but they until now they all had to have Chinese domination, Chinese majority share owning. This will be the first one that doesn't. And George Soros is saying, oh, this is horrible because we don't want BlackRock investing in China, because if BlackRock invests in China, then China can become the dominant economic power. And, they're not going to do it the American way, which I guess means the Jewish way. And so he was talking about kind of the controversy there between George Soros on the one hand and BlackRock on the other. And he was saying what George Soros doesn't seem to understand is China doesn't need BlackRock's money in the first place.
Exactly. And what a lot of people fail to realize, too, is that there's nothing goes above the Chinese nation. Nothing goes above the Chinese state. So even though BlackRock might have, quote unquote, majority interest in one of their markets, it's still under
his control. One of the markets, but and this is what I think the fascination people have been missing. They in one player in one market. Okay, so you've got a stock market, you've got investment funds already, you've got plenty of investment funds, but now there will be one among many that doesn't, but a single one that won't have Chinese majority ownership.
Yeah, exactly, but it's still under heavy Chinese monitoring and control. Like China, people don't understand. China can crack down anytime they want to if there's corruption, because their government, the state, and they have that power to do so. Unlike the U.S. government, which is all controlled by financial corporate oligarch interests, China is actually controlled by the people.
And this has been one of the things that has been a complaint by Americans or Westerners or whomever about doing business in China, is that from the Western point of view, the Chinese government seems like it can be kind of arbitrary, because you set up some sort of deal. You think you've got an agreement, and then the Chinese look at it and say, wait a minute, we don't like the way this is going, and they shut it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They just automatically come in and shut it down, and that's it. If they see that if they deem that it imperils the interests of the nation, of the people, it's shut down. So, no, BlackRock doesn't have, absolute power in their little share of the pie. Even that still is subject to Chinese law. And, and here's the other thing, too. BlackRock, they wanted to do more with China. There's a lot of things that China have said that have actually come out and said, no, BlackRock, you can't do this, you can't do that. They actually want to, there's a lot more they want to do in China, but China actually says no. But somehow it's just this one yes that, you know, people in the alternative media keep focusing on.
Yeah, and the thing is, this has been going on for decades. The American government, and we know who it's dominated by, American government in particular, and other Western governments have been putting pressure on China to open up, to reciprocate, because the Chinese obviously they invest big time in America and Europe and Japan. They invest big time in a lot of places, and yet there's not the reciprocal opportunities for foreign investors to get into China. And so China's been under a whole lot of pressure, and if they want to continue to be able to invest in foreign countries, they have to make concessions here and there. But my position is, if you look at things over these past 30 years, the Chinese have conceded very little for what they've gotten. And I think this is, you can say the exact same thing with trade. And I think President Trump was correct in recognizing that. I'm not going all Q-tard and Trump magapede here, but I'm just saying that the Chinese, whether you're talking about trade, whether you're talking about investment, were able to get deals that were favorable to them. But every deal, you're making some sort of concession to get things that you want.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. Should I? I guess I'll continue the continue.
Yeah. Go whatever direction you want.
All right, so here is continuing the video.
And so most of the financial strategy of Wall Street thinks, how can we get something for nothing? Mm-hmm. How can we get a free lunch? Well, that begins by telling people, having Milton Friedman as a kind of sock puppet, saying there is no such thing as a free lunch, when the whole of Wall Street is looking for a free lunch. They're looking to grab Chinese assets on the cheap, like Soros is grabbing post-Soviet assets. They're looking for monopoly rights. They're looking for lending money and let China do the work, just pay the interest to the Americans that are going to be providing it with money that the Federal Reserve ends up creating on its computers, or that George Soros already has saved, largely by how he got the free lunch from the Bank of England betting against it and driving sterling down.
Some people call it the free world. Others call it a democracy. Others, for America, call it an advanced oligarchy. Do you think that the Chinese have looked at America and the wider West, understood that privatizing all that rent has ultimately led to societal decline?
They're beginning to look at it that way. Most Chinese Marxists focused on Volume 1 of Capital, which is all about employers hiring workers and making a putting them to work and making a profit off the markup. Only right in the last couple of years has Volume 2 and Volume 3 of Capital moved into central discussion in China. And it's Volume 2 and 3 that talk about economic rent. And so China has come to realize that, wait a minute, the United States is not an industrial economy. We're not going to understand what's happening in the United States, in England, in Europe, by looking at what Marx wrote in Volume 1 of Capital, because they're not making money industrially anymore. They're making money by being a rentier economy, by landlordism, by monopolies, and by bank credit, which Marx discussed in Volume 2 and 3. So they're now broadening the discussion, and for the first time, you're having, especially in the last few weeks, the last month, really, China's talking about, wait a minute, do we want to let Chinese investors make money financially by buying housing, becoming absentee landlords, and hoping that there's going to be a housing price inflation like you have in the United States, or do we want to keep housing low priced and not bid it up by credit creation and financing? So they're now realizing that if you want to keep China's cost of living low, you have to keep the price of housing low. And that means you don't want housing to become a commodity, an investment vehicle for absentee owners and landlords to make money. You want housing to be for Chinese people to live in, actually. And that means you want low-priced housing, not debt-leveraged housing, as they're seeing in the United States.
Okay. Well, we're right up on the break. Let's the break this on the other side. Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Kosher-tified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Kosher-tified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
All right, we are back. So we had just played this clip of Michael Hudson, and you know, he's talking about the Chinese economy. What do we make of what he had to say?
Well, he was saying that in this last part, he was saying basically that China's when it comes to the housing market, that China is more concerned about people actually getting to live in those houses and use those houses for, you know, their actual, you know, an actual living, as opposed to just an investment property where it just sits there and collects, basically accumulates in money over time. And China's more interested in actually using the houses for what it's meant for, which is for people living. Whereas in the U.S., you see all these, you know, like BlackRock and all these other Jewish and even non-Jewish investment firms buying up all these properties, buying up all these houses and holding onto them just so that way they'll increase in the value and making it unaffordable for people to buy houses in the U.S., you know, especially young people like myself, where it's very difficult for young people to buy a house these days just because of how expensive it is because of this predatory investment and holding onto these houses and not letting them be what they're meant to be used for.
You know, we have a lot of weird things that go on in our real estate market. And, you know, one thing that we have that the Chinese probably don't is, you know, we've got the black issue. So you go to Cleveland, for instance, and you go through neighborhoods in Cleveland and certainly any Rust Belt city and probably a lot of other, you know, places around America, too. And you go to the black neighborhoods and there's lots and lots of abandoned vacant houses. And you go to Detroit, downtown Detroit, and you've even got abandoned vacant sky rises, you know, 30, 40 story tall buildings that are vacant and abandoned. And, you know, one of the things I guess we won't have time to get to, but there was a phenomenon in China of building new urban centers that wound up not getting used and they're just sitting there.
Yeah, he talks about that.
Well, go for it.
Right after. Well, he basically just talks about that. The clip's a little too long to play, but he talks about how it's because China, you see this, when the central planning was the initial plan was that they were anticipating that all the people from the rural areas would move into these you know, big high rises, these Lanwei buildings, as we call it in Chinese, or these ghost cities. But that didn't happen. So
because they're doing a better job of making the countryside better. And so people aren't leaving. And they also have, like, internal travel regulations that can keep people down on the farm, but they're making the farms and the villages better.
Right. They've definitely taken that shift in this last 5-year plan to shift from development in the cities to development in the rural countryside, to where now they're improving the rural parts and not so much as thinking, okay, how do we, you know, migrate all these people into these high-rise cities? Which, you know, they've actually been tearing a lot of them down now because it didn't plan as expected to.
And, you know, I guess this is something that happens in the developing world is the rapid urbanization. But life on the farm, life in the countryside doesn't have to be worse. And you look at America there may be a variety of particular reasons for it. But life in the American rural areas isn't bad. And life in Japanese rural areas isn't bad. And it doesn't have to be bad in China either.
And the reason, I think one of the main reasons why life in the rural areas in America isn't bad is because you don't have
you have particular ethnic mixes. We'll just leave it at that because we're out of time. But thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Slattery. Good to be back. Talk to you all next week.
Okay, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Legal Radio.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
You're listening to Republic.